This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Welcome to the Journal of Neurosurgery podcast for February 11th, 2011. I'm Natalie Pynchon. I will be reading a summary of some of the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery today. Topics covered in this podcast are hydrocephalus, functional neurosurgery, vascular disorders, oncology, and peripheral nerve. Laparoscopic versus open insertion of the peritoneal catheter in ventriculoperitoneal shunt placement. Review of 810 consecutive cases. A clinical article by Robert Naftel and colleagues. Traditional ventriculoperitoneal shunt surgery involves insertion of the distal catheter by mini laparotomy. However, mini laparotomy can be a source of morbidity during shunt surgery. Laparoscopic insertion of the distal catheter is an alternative technique that may simplify and improve the safety of shunt surgery. The authors retrospectively compared outcomes in 475 patients undergoing laparoscopic shunt insertion and 335 patients undergoing open shunt insertion. The most common indications for shunt treatment were subarachnoid hemorrhage, tumor, normal pressure hydrocephalus, and trauma. The mean follow-up times were 12 months in the laparoscopic group and 21 months in the open group. Laparoscopic patients had significantly shorter operative times and a shorter mean length of hospital stay. There was no statistically significant difference in the incidence of shunt failure in the two groups, with shunt failure occurring in 20% of the laparoscopic and 20.9% of open cases, and there was no difference in mean time to shunt failure. Shunt obstruction occurred significantly more often in the open cohort. The relative risk of distal obstruction in open cases compared to laparoscopic cases was 7.5. The differences in infection rates were not statistically significant, with infection occurring in 8.2% of laparoscopic cases and 6.6% of open cases. Within the normal pressure hydrocephalus subgroup, laparoscopically treated patients had significantly more overdrainage, while those in the open cohort experienced significantly more shunt obstructions. Real-time control of a prosthetic hand using human electrocorticography signals. A technical note by Takofumi Yanagisawa and co-authors. Patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or stroke sometimes go into a total locked-in state in which they cannot move their muscles at all, even when they are clearly willing them to act. A brain-machine interface, or BMI, is one of the ways to improve their quality of life. The BMI infers the patient's will using only the individual's brain signals, and it translates these signals to control external devices, such as a prosthetic hand. In this study, the authors succeeded in developing an integrated BMI system that controls a prosthetic hand in real time using human electrocorticography signals. Notably, this new system was successfully used with surprisingly good results by a patient after he had suffered a stroke. The authors found that the patient's hand movements were correctly detected and inferred only from the electrocorticography signals recorded in the patient's sensory motor cortex. The prosthetic hand was able to mimic the patient's movements in real time. This is the first report to describe the use of electrocorticography signals to control a prosthetic hand. This success may lead to the development of a clinically feasible BMI system that uses the safe and stable electrocorticography signals. The method described by the authors paves the way for the restoration of motor function in paralyzed patients using a prosthetic arm controlled by a BMI through electrocorticography signals. Geographic variation and regional trends in adoption of endovascular techniques for cerebral aneurysms. A clinical article by Gabriel Smith and co-workers. Development of endovascular therapies has led to fundamental change in treatment of ruptured and unruptured cerebral aneurysms. The authors reviewed the National Inpatient Sample Database, which revealed that by 2008, the majority of aneurysms in the United States were treated endovascularly. Hospital costs and patient mortality were influenced primarily by presenting diagnosis, with diagnosis of subarachnoid hemorrhage correlating with highest inpatient mortality and highest hospital charges. Further analysis of the database showed significant regional variation in percentage of patients treated endovascularly. A greater number of states with high percentage of endovascularly treated patients were found east of the Mississippi River and along the Pacific coast. Fewer aneurysms were treated endovascularly in the Midwest and South. This finding did not correlate with population distributions, with some large states having low utilization of endovascular therapy. The NIS database reveals a significant increase in the use of endovascular techniques and wider acceptance of these techniques in the neurosurgical community by 2008. The heterogeneity of adoption of endovascular techniques may question the assumption that all U.S. residents have access to the same medical technologies. Geographic variation in technology availability and accessibility may occur. These variations question previous assumptions with regard to the uniform availability of technology in the U.S. healthcare system. Quality of life in patients with intracranial gliomas. The impact of modern image-guided surgery. A clinical article by Asker Yakola and colleagues. Surprisingly little is known about how modern glioma surgery affects quality of life. Usually, gross outcomes are evaluated by the treating physicians. However, patient perceptions of his or her own health may differ. This introduces potential bias to the literature. 88 adult patients with glioma were prospectively included in the present study. The authors evaluated the Karnofsky Performance Scale score and the EuroQol 5D index. The EuroQol is a generic instrument for measuring quality of life. The EuroQol index and Karnofsky Performance Scale were strongly correlated, and the EuroQol offered a more detailed description of outcome. Overall, there was no change in quality of life after surgery. Acquired deficits, occipital lesions, and no ultrasonography in resection control were independently associated with a deterioration in the quality of life postoperatively. The extent of resection was not important for change in quality of life in patients in this study. This contradicts reports from retrospective studies and demonstrates the importance of adjusting for preoperative status when evaluating for the effects of surgery. The authors conclude that the EuroQol seems promising as an outcome measure in a population with glioma. The surgical procedure per se and the extent of resection may not significantly alter quality of life in the average patient with glioma, at least not in the short term. New deficits, to no surprise, have a major undesirable effect. Topographic relationship between the medial intermuscular septum and the ulnar nerve in the upper arm. A laboratory investigation by Hyung-Soon Won and co-authors. The authors have observed the ulnar nerve passing through the medial intermuscular septum into the posterior compartment of the upper arm in more complicated patterns than those described in anatomy textbooks. Given that these unreported patterns might be related to the idiopathic ulnar nerve entrapment at the mid-arm, this study was focused on the relationship between the medial intermuscular septum and the ulnar nerve. 100 upper arms were dissected, and the site at which the ulnar nerve pierced the medial intermuscular septum was analyzed and measured from the medial epicondyle. The relationship between the medial intermuscular septum and the ulnar nerve could be classified into three types according to whether the nerve pierced the medial intermuscular septum and whether it ran through a fibrous tunnel within the septum. The ulnar nerve pierced the medial intermuscular septum in the middle third of the upper arm. The results of this study are expected to further the understanding of the relationship between these two structures. It could also be helpful for surgeons aiming to relieve ulnar nerve entrapment at the mid-arm, especially in nerve lesions of idiopathic origin. Thank you for listening to the Journal of Neurosurgery. To listen to more of our podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.